medical vision. One of your founders, Douglas Johnson, he asked this question in the book, The Influence of Christians in Medicine, on page 172. He says, does being a Christian then make no difference? And this is a question I'm hoping to answer today. I think there are several major differences. And probably the most important difference is the fact that the Christian vision is about following a person and not really an ideology. Because truth is not an ideology, truth is a person. Because Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And then again, when Jesus called his disciples, he never challenged them and said, come, let's bring about justice. Let's reduce the disease burden in Judea or Samaria. You know, it was not about any ideology, any value, any activity. It was about following himself. We find that when he called Matthew, he said, follow me. And when he called Peter, he said, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. And when he talked to some of his disciples, he said, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. Again, another context. He told his disciples, who wants to be my disciple must deny himself, take up the cross, and follow me. And again, you know, we have that theme repeated several times in the scripture. Actually, does it make any difference at all whether you follow an ideology or whether you follow a person? Does it make difference in practical life? And I want to give you some examples from history to sort of illustrate that difference. We know about Robespierre. You know, he was the architect of the French Revolution. He is not well thought of, but the fact is that he was a very good man for a start. There's a book written about him by Ruth Curry. She's a Cambridge scholar. And she's written a book called The Fate of Purity. That means, how can such a good man, an incorruptible man, become such a bloodthirsty dictator? It's been an enigma for modern historians. You know, Robespierre started off being very hardworking, intelligent. He had great concern for the poor. He was known as the incorruptible one. It was one of the reasons why he was mentored into being a leader of the French Revolution. He was a great idealist. He was a great moralist. He gave a lot of his own resources for the poor. And he had a really strong sense of justice and used to fight for other people's rights. So, you know, he was if there was ever a person who was a real ideologist, it was him. And obviously, this is the reason why he rose to the top and became the leader of the French Revolution. But because he was committed to an ideology and because he was not committed to a person, what happened was, when he encountered resistance to his own ideology, he became paranoid. He began to implicate people without evidence and be thrown without a trial. And, you know, he began to implicate people without a proper trial. And later on, towards the end of his life, he became a god of a new, he pronounced himself a bit of a god of a new religious order. And, of course, he had become so incorrigible that they had to actually behead him himself. And this is not simply the story of one isolated person who followed an ideology. Most of the murderers in history, they had great ideologies. You concerned about the law, they were worried about justice, and then, you know, they ended up being absolute disasters. And then we have the story of Ignatius of Loyola. He was the founder of the Society of Jesus. He lived during troubled times, during the post-Reformation period. And he was converted after being injured in battle in his sort of convalescing bed when someone witnessed him about Christ. And then he decided to follow Christ, and he decided to take up the cause of counter-revolution, counter-reformation. And one of the things he did was start the Society of Jesus. And it became, after about 10, 15 years, it became a big movement. But before actually the Pope sanctioned and officially recognized it, there was a little problem in the society. There was a scandal. And the scandal was serious enough for the Pope to consider closing down the Society of Jesus. And so some people asked him, Ignatius, what will happen if the Pope actually closes down the Society? What will you do? And Ignatius said, you know, I'll pray for 15 minutes and then I'll forget about it. This is because his calling was to a person, it was not to an ideology. You know, if he was following the counter-reformation ideology, he had the option, because he was a soldier and because he had a lot of resources at his beck and call, he could have easily challenged the Pope and created a lot of trouble. But he said, you know, I'm not about an ideology, I'm about a person. And then he was willing to forget about this. And so we find that because of that sort of approach, the Society of Jesus is one of the most sustained, shall we say, NGO. It has lasted about 400 years. Recently, and I've got a lot of quotations from the Catholics, but you know, I'm not a Catholic. The Pope Francis, he recently described ideological Christians as a serious illness within the church. Now, what does that mean? He said, he says that the knowledge of Jesus is transformed into an ideological and moralistic knowledge. That means we are forgetting the person of Christ and we just only hang on to the ideology. And that is very dangerous and is very frightening. And he says that this is because of lack of true prayer. That means lack of connection with the person of Christ. So the Christian vision is about following a person. But other kinds of vision, the secular vision, is about following an ideology. Another way of understanding that is, you know, I have categorized vision into three kinds. When your vision is only about yourself, I call that the narrative. You know, it's just the story is only about yourself. Your agenda is about yourself. When the world dictates your agenda, that's a group, better than being very self-centered. That's the majority. You know, you're crossing the self-boundary and allowing the world to set your agenda. But again, that is not enough. The Christian vision is about the grand narrative. You're allowing God himself to set your agenda. The Christian vision is about the grand narrative. It's not about the meta narrative. It's not simply about what is needed in the world. It's not simply about what you want. It's about what God really wants you to do. And then kinds of vision relates to the understanding of suffering. Kevin introduced me as someone from a Jain background. And in the Jain religion, suffering is seen as a punishment for past sins, either in this life or in a previous life. You know, that's called a lot of karma. So it doesn't really help when you're suffering to know that this is a punishment. The secular understanding of suffering is that suffering is meaningless. Nietzsche, in his book called The Birth of Tragedy, you know, he was terminally ill, and when he was terminally ill, he wrote this. He said, "What is best of all is utterly beyond your reach, not to be bound, not to be given up to you." He says, human suffering is so great that it is better for us not to have been born at all. And then he says, of course, you can't control that. So the next best thing for you to do is to die. Which means it's sort of he sets the platform for euthanasia. It's because of this concept of suffering, which is meaningless. But the Christian understanding of suffering is that it is redemptive. It is neither punishment nor is it meaningless, but it is a very positive connotation. The genius of God can use your suffering and bring in any situation for your own. Clear will be raised. The Christian God is with us in the big shining of pain and suffering. Now, this is the Christian understanding, which is so very positive. And it is this understanding that equips us to engage with suffering in our patients. I know of no theology or no kind of secular approach that will adequately address the problem of suffering. What happens is it really important that we accept suffering positively or not? Does it make any difference in real life? And let me share some stories. There was this Jew called Elie Wiesel. He was ushered into the concentration camp at the age of 15. And later on, when he was released, he wrote this book called The Night, and he was given the Nobel Peace Prize. His father, his mother, and a lot of his relatives, all of them were interned in Auschwitz, and all of them died. He was the only one who survived. And then in his book, The Night, he writes this. He says, "Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp, which has turned my life into one long night. Seven times cursed and seven times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath the silent blue sky. Never shall I forget those flames which consumed my faith forever." And then there was a time when, you know, the inmates of the concentration camp were celebrating the Jewish New Year, and part of the celebration was giving thanks to God. And this is what he wrote. He refused to take part in that particular celebration. And he wrote this. He said, "Blessed be God's name. Why? Why should I bless him? Every fiber in me repent. Because he caused thousands of children to burn in his mass graves. Because he kept six crematoria working day and night, including Sabbath and the holy days. Because in his great might, he had created Auschwitz, etc., etc. right, so many factors of that. How could I say to him, "Blessed be thou Almighty"? He said, "I'm instead accusing God." But we have another person who suffered similarly in a concentration camp. That is the story of Corrie ten Boom. You're probably familiar with that story. How she was hiding things in her home, and she was discovered, and she was sent to a concentration camp where her father and sister and her nephew died. Yet she became one of the greatest evangelists of the 20th century. That is really triumph of faith over suffering. While Jesus says, "I will never say, 'Blessed be your name,'" Corrie ten Boom says, "However deep the pit, God's love is deeper still." So you can see what a huge difference the attitude to suffering can make in individual lives. So how can we suffer well? Nietzsche has a point. He says, "He who has a why can suffer anyhow." That means if you have some kind of a goal, and if you have some kind of a meaning, you can suffer well. But Christian Ranger, he goes another step further. He says, if you know the who in your life, you can suffer anyhow. That means if you know a person, you can suffer that way. And so we want our patients to know a person so that they can suffer well. And I want to talk to you about the difference between an individual and about a person. But let me first tell you the story. You probably know that. About the story of Narcissus and Echo. How Narcissus is supposed to be the son of river Sisyphus. How he fell in love with his own image. And erotic activity with his own image was frustrating. And since he could not part with his image, he dies at the edge of the pool and becomes a lily. He had no eyes for a person, you know, Echo was there, but he was really not interested in another. He was interested only in himself. You might think this is just a story, but the fact is that a lot of us are becoming individuals. An individual is atomized. Not a molecule, but an atom. He's all by himself. He worries first for his rights. He belongs to the me generation. And he wants to be free of everything and everyone. And that's what an individual might look like. And this is what a person might look like. A person who's connected with others. Where am I going with all this? You know, in the story of the brain divorce, C.S. Lewis's book, there was a guy who was scouting Greytown. Greytown is in a hell. Is it going to be long term or voluntary? Is it going to be short term? Greytown, he finds that people initially they build their houses close to each other, and then they cannot get along with each other, and so they move their houses further apart, and then there's a point when they cannot even bear to see the houses in the distance, and so they move even further apart. And in one of these houses, C.S. Lewis pictures Napoleon. And Napoleon is going up and down, just talking to himself. Engrossed and talking to himself. But there's a picture of an individual who is completely engrossed with himself. What we want to do is we want to tell this world that you don't have to be an individual. We want you to be connected. Because that is what health is all about. You know, business is how people find them to die because of the disconnection. But a monk who is praying in a cloister will survive and they remain happy. And so our message to our patients is one of the things we want to do is get them connected and establish a relationship with God and with the others because that is part of being healthy. And so this is the Christian understanding that we are persons. We cannot just be individuals. We have to learn to be connected with God and with others. The next huge difference between the two attitudes, the secular and the Christian, is the attitude to knowledge. Paul says, knowledge offered not, but love edifies. And he says, love never fails, but knowledge will cease. Now, what does he exactly mean? One attitude to knowledge, one of the secular attitudes to knowledge, is to use knowledge for power. I suspect that plenty of people want to become doctors because of the power and the control that they might enjoy over people. Pope Benedict, the previous pope, he wrote about the prophecies of the child of the birth of Christ and about the childhood of Jesus. And he called it the infancy narratives. He said 3 volumes. And in one of those volumes, he talks about the peddlers of knowledge. And he says that the chief priests and the scribes were mere peddlers of knowledge. They knew the scriptures, they knew Christ, where Christ would be born. But when King Herod asked them about where Christ might be born, they did not really hesitate at all, and they told him where he might be born. But the fact of the matter is that King Herod had a evil reputation. He was known to be bloodthirsty dictator. He was known to have killed one of his family members for the sake of power. He was known to have killed a lot of the guys. And it was common knowledge that he would do away with anyone who sort of challenges upon him. And in spite of this knowledge, this chief priest and this scribe just sold the knowledge to him and with very bad consequences. And so this is one attitude to knowledge, being just peddlers of knowledge, selling knowledge. And then the other attitude that is more common in our country is the worship of knowledge. Well, the Greeks worship knowledge, goddess Epistine. And in India we have a goddess called Goddess Saraswati, whom they worship just before examinations. And of course, the Gnostics believe in salvation through knowledge. And a lot of the Hindus also believe in salvation through knowledge. Knowing quite a lot will save you, not necessarily the change of the attitude. We have other examples of Christian examples of worship of knowledge. Dr. Faust, in a novel, he sold his soul to the devil so that he might know. And these are the two secular attitudes now, using knowledge as power base, being peddlers of knowledge, and sort of worshiping knowledge. But Paul says that if you use knowledge for power, then it will puff you up. service tool, then you will be in heaven. And so that is the big difference between the Christian understanding or attitude to knowledge and the secular attitude to knowledge. We use knowledge for service, and others might use knowledge for power and for control. This is sometime in the 60s. This is a Christian medical college. Hello. This is a Christian institution. What will happen is this medical students will go into an opening. They will examine a patient, one, two, or three patients that will have an opening. They will do, you know, a examination or whatever. They will appreciate the clinical findings, have a clinic, and then driving naked without any food and wondering what will happen to him next. And one member of the evangelical union, one young lady, she could not tolerate this. She went up to the medical superintendent and said, "Sir, I'm aghast at what is happening in the hospital." She said, "You get patients, they get examined by us, you don't feed them, you don't explain anything to them, and when everything is over, they have to fend for themselves. Is that how, is that justice? Is that how you should be treating human beings?" And that brought about, to the credit of the institution, they took that comment from just every young medical student seriously, and they brought about reforms, so that every patient who gets examined would get paid, would get free treatment, would get advice about what happens and stuff like that. And so I call that the professional orientation. That means you treat patients. The question you ask is, how can this patient help me professionally? What can this patient teach me? That's a professional orientation. And even in below, we have that sort of orientation. And then there is a commercial orientation. That's very obvious. But there is in the West what is called a patient orientation. That means, how can I satisfy this patient? She wants me to do. That is good, but it is not good enough. The Christian understanding is, how can I best help him? Now, what is the difference between the providing orientation? For example, a woman comes, my sister's daughter, who's a dentist, she came to me and said, I want an abortion. Can you help me find a good obstetrician or gynecologist who will do that? So if she goes to a OB specialist, they'll just do whatever she wants. But I said, "No, why are you doing that?" Because, you know, you have no problem. You're very healthy. You can easily have another baby. The first son is already 6 years old. And she said, it interfered with my dentistry. I'm very busy. And so we had some discussion. Charlie, my wife, offered to adopt the baby if she's willing not to abort. But in spite of our discussion, she still went ahead with that. But the fact is, we at least were able to challenge her decision. We simply don't do whatever she wants us to do for her. So that is the Christian orientation. Doing what is right in God's eyes, what is good for the patient in terms of eternity, not whatever she wants. whatever he or she wants. And then finally, Christian vision is different from a secular vision in that with the Christian vision is about relevance rather than doing exotic things. Let me give you an example. Sometime in the 11th or 12th century in the Byzantium, they had these pillar saints. And these pillar saints were perched on top of pillars. And they would stay there for long periods of time. I think the record is like 30 years. And they would not come down, they would just manage everything there. But at that particular time in history, the whole of Europe was in a mess. There was famine, there was war, there was pestilence, there was smallpox, there was plague, injustice, and a lot of illiteracy. But here, where the pillar saints perched on top of a pillar, supposed to be men of God, were supposed to be showcasing what Christianity was all about. Is that relevant at all? You know, the world is in a mess and these people are sitting on a pillar. I mean, it seems like a bit of a joke, but that can be true about the medical practice today. Saint Simeon spent 68 years on a pillar. Sorry, that requires 68 years. And then we have in India, we have festivals in India. They're called the Kumbh Mela. Every 12 years, there is a huge festival where all the Hindus come and worship the godmen. And in one of those festivals in Allahabad, there was this man who had kept his hand up for 12 years, and then it got at almost fixed. And worship him. And this man would bury himself up to the neck and people would come and worship him. What I'm trying to say is religion needs to be relevant to people's need. You cannot simply do something that is exotic and exciting but not relevant. Some of you must have heard of Paul Rand. Look at Paul Rand, you know. Very briefly an opportunity of working with him. He came to India during the Second World War. And in those days, in Christian Medical College, there was no subject department of orthopedics, you know, general surgery and orthopedics were the same. And so they asked him to develop the department. It may have been like one of the first ones in the country. It was sort of exciting. He worked for a little while, but he began to see the needs among leprosy patients. Manila was the capital, leprosy capital of the world. 1 million leprosy patients lived all around the world. And he saw their poor hands, and he saw their poverty, and he said, I think I want to do something about this problem. Maybe I can do something about the hands. If only I can straighten the hands, then they will be able to do some useful work. They can manage a job, and they will be independent. And so it began a journey of doing something for the persecution. He studied the mechanics of the hand, of the lumbrical muscle, and discovered that by doing a tendon transplant, you could augment the function of the lumbrical muscles and reverse the throwing. It was called EF4T, that means extensor flexor forte transfer. So the first time in the world that operation was done in the and then it was stopped right away. The guy also got the operation. And thousands and thousands of representations were operated upon. And they found jobs. They found dignity. And so this is an example of not doing something that is exotic, prestigious, but doing something that is really relevant. And relevance means reality. You are coming to grips with reality. And reality means moving out of your comfort zone. And so the question that we started initially was, does being a Christian then make no difference? And I think the answer is, it makes all the difference. In fact, there can be no